Coming up, Lab and I break down Sam Burns' breakout victory in Tampa and dig into when an invitation isn't an invitation. Welcome to the Golf Central Podcast presented by Callaway Golf. Valspar Championship winner Sam Burns plays the Callaway Chrome Soft X golf ball. He says it's, quote, so fast and gives him all the shots he needs. This is back-to-back wins on the PGA Tour for the Chrome Soft family after Mark Leishman won at the Zurich Classic with a Chrome Soft X LS. This shows these balls aren't just better, they're better for everyone. Learn more about the Chrome Soft family at CallawayGolf.com. Also, while you're there, check out Sam Burns' episode On the Jump, a Callaway original, which profiles the young rising star. Speaking of the young rising star, let's get to young Sam. Two things came to mind. I was a little late to the show on Sunday afternoon because I had a lot of things going on in my household, and I was grilling, which we'll get to at the end of the podcast because we have to do, we can't miss what Lab was smoking 2 weeks in a row. But my first question is, when I tuned in, I tuned in late on the back nine. I assumed it was going to be a shootout between Keegan Bradley and Sam Burns, and it was not. So I immediately went to the question. I was going to text you, and I didn't. But did Sam win this, or did Keegan lose it?
Sam most certainly won it, shooting 68 on a day when the golf course is playing as difficult as it had all week. The wind was starting to get fresh. And you got to keep in mind, this is a player who's never won on the PGA Tour before. And so I thought the way that he handled himself, he looked like he'd been there dozens of times. And we can kind of get into how he's been trending in this direction over the past season or so. But I mean, Keegan hit just an absolutely terrible shot. It was a poor time to do that on the par three with water short. He just kind of came out of it, flared it right, and ended up making a double. He made another bogey over the last couple of holes, and he actually did well just to finish solo second, which, yeah, that's a bummer finish for Keegan Bradley, who hasn't won since 2018. And he's certainly going to rue the poor tee shot that he hit on 13. But all in all, this was all about Sam Burns. This was a player who has been number one in the world as a junior player. He was the top college player in the country when he played for LSU in 2017, winning the Jack Nicklaus Award. And so this is kind of the natural progression. This is a player who's looked like a PGA Tour player for the past decade, and now he's playing like one, and he has a PGA Tour trophy to show for it.
Does it feel like at 24, and you start putting him into categories with some of the other 24-year-olds who are out on tour right now, and you follow this much better than I do because you pick him up through college, did he have a higher ceiling than maybe some of the other 24-year-olds that we refer to, or maybe he was a little overlooked?
I think he was kind of right in the middle. I kind of go back to Jordan Spieth kind of started this wave or this revolution of 20-something stars when he kind of burst on the scene the spring of 2013 as a 19-year-old. And so actually for the Monday Scramble column that I did today, I listed like who are the top men's players under the age of 25, because I thought surely Sam Burns, who could have won in Houston, he could have won at Riviera. Now he wins against a good field on a good golf course like Innisbrook. I said, surely he has to crack the top five of great players under the age of 25, right? Except I'm not even sure he cracks the top 10.
No, come on.
Still under the age of 25 are Colin Morikawa, who I would put number one on that list.
Sure.
Victor Hovland. Joaquin Niemann is in his fourth season on the PGA Tour. He's only 22 years old. So Joaquin Niemann, a winner on the PGA Tour, I think I would put him third on that list. And then you've got Sung J.M. You've got Will Zalatoris, who nearly won the Masters. And then you're still getting into guys like Scottie Scheffler and Matthew Wolff and Robert McIntyre, who's been very good left-hander on the European Tour. And even further down the list, you can start to look at guys like Garrick Higo, who's won on the European Tour just as recently as 2 weeks ago. Takumi Kanaya has been mopping up in Japan. He's just 22 years old. Like, it is deep under the age of 25. And Sam Burns is a very good player. Keegan Bradley predicted this is a kid who's going to win a lot of golf tournaments. But there's a lot of kids his age Sam Burns is 24. There's a lot of kids his age who are already more accomplished and probably still have higher ceilings than Sam Burns.
I would be curious to see what you feel like the weakness is, because it doesn't seem like last week in Tampa was any indication. Putting's not the issue. I mean, it was 9.5 strokes, I believe, gained on the field, which is second only to that unbelievable performance that Luke Donald did a few years ago. So it doesn't seem like putting's the issue. And I've seen he's got plenty of power off the tee. So where are you seeing the weakness?
I'm not sure it's a weakness. I'm not sure that he has the top level game. If you look at statistically, nothing really stands out. When you see him play golf, he clearly has one speed and one speed only, and that's hitting it very, very hard. But I mean, he's above average in basically everything except his short game. I mean, he's above average in distance. I think he averages like 307 yards off the tee, which is, you know, top tier of the PGA Tour. I'd say probably top 20, top 30. He's a good iron player. As you mentioned, his putting is actually pretty underrated. And so I just pulled it up right here. So he ranks 25th on the PGA Tour at strokes gained total. So that's, you know, taking in mind all of the various statistics that you can measure a player against his peers. That's pretty good. That's 25th for a guy who's seeing these golf courses now for the first or second, or in some cases, the third time. Look, I think he's a very good player, and I think he's going to win somewhere probably between 5 and 10 PGA Tour events in his career. But if you're asking me, is he going to be a producer like Colin Morikawa has been a producer, or Victor Hovland has produced, or
Will and Joaquin, Zalatoris. you're gonna put Joaquin ahead of him.
Yeah. Yes. I would say no. I still think he has to do some refining in his game. He's still, I think, to me, very raw, and he needs to still develop kind of some of the off speed pitches. Like you'll see some of these top players in the world, like Justin Thomas and John Rahm. He needs to develop an off speed pitch, but his fastball is clearly very good.
So I fell off my chair right onto the office floor, because normally you are all in when it comes to these young players coming out of college.
I'm measured.
No, you're never measured. You're usually all in. You're usually in for these players from the very, very get-go. You're the one that wanted Jordan Spieth to get to get picked for the Ryder Cup team in his very first go-around.
He should have.
Again, this is you. This is the argument. You go all in. There is no half speed for you. So I'm just curious, in this particular situation, you clearly see something in Sam that you're not all sold on, despite the fact that, as you just pointed out, 13th in strokes gained putting this season on tour, as opposed to 50th in strokes gained off the tee. So those are the two things, and we have this conversation about Morikawa, it seems like, on a weekly basis, that if you're going to look at the three things a player needs to do, Morikawa doesn't do two of those things very, very consistently. It seems to me, at least this season, a short season, but a season nonetheless, that Sam is doing those things, at least two of them, more consistently, and yet you have no interest in putting him in the top 10 of 25 and unders.
I gave 10 names. I'd put him ahead of Takumi Kanaya and Garrick Higo, most certainly.
Now you're backpedaling. I see what you're doing now.
I didn't rank six through 10. I just kind of threw out some other names. If you actually read the column, you would have seen this. You can't put him ahead of Morikawa, Hovland, Niemann, Sung Jae-im, and Will Zalatoris. You just can't do it.
I would put him ahead of Niemann. I would.
You would put him ahead of Joaquin Niemann.
I think everyone I talk to.
Niemann's won eight times as a pro.
Everybody I've talked to that knows anything about the golf swing will point to that golf swing and say, yeah, that's not going to hold up. Like, I mean, we can sit here and make predictions, and we can say.
Brandel Chamblee said that's one of the best golf swings on the PGA Tour. Brandel Chamblee.
Brandel loves it. Every other swing coach I've talked to said that swing doesn't hold up for the long term. Thankfully, he's in his, you know, early 20s, so it's fine right now. And we all know how that feels. How's it going to feel 20 years from now? My guess is not great.
All right, so I'm going to put Sam Burns eighth currently. I would put him ahead of those five guys who I just mentioned. Scottie Scheffler, would you put him ahead of Scottie Scheffler?
No, because I know I've seen.
Would
a lot
you put
of
him ahead of Matthew
stuff
Wolf?
From
I didn't even mention Matthew Wolf
right now. Absolutely.
Well, right. I think.
Are you kidding me?
I think I would put you and your birdie at Torrey Pines ahead of Matthew Wolf. I think the Valspar was very important for Sam Burns, and because we're just going to run through some of these things. I think you covered Riviera this year. Did you?
I was at Riv. He was leading by five strokes after
five.
Two rounds.
He was leading by five at the halfway point.
Should have won that.
Played a poor third round. I think he shot 69 in the final round and ended up losing to Max Homa, who prevailed in a playoff. And so here's a couple stats that I actually found very surprising. Sam Burns has been inside the top five now through 36 holes in five events on the PGA Tour. That's the most of any player. And so if he had been a little bit better closing, you're looking at a guy who wouldn't just have his first win at the Valspar. I mean, he could have closed out a number of those tournaments, whether it was in Napa, Houston. He played a really poor round when that was the first time that he held a 54 hole lead. Riviera, we just talked about the backtrack there. Like he has been in the mix, and you get him on the right golf course on Bermuda greens that he's grown up putting on. Yeah. Yeah. He's probably going to be a threat, but he has the most positions inside the top five through 36 holes. He's tied with Jordan Spieth for the most 54 hole leads on the PGA Tour with three. So this has already been now a good season. If he converts those, or if he does now convert those, knowing what he does now about what it takes to win on Sundays, I think he could potentially turn this into a great season, maybe finish inside the top 10, the season long FedEx Cup standings.
And I know it was a team event, but at the Zurich Classic, when he was paired with Billy Horschel, Billy told me, like, look, man, this kid
he's
is
carrying me.
And he carried him. Absolutely. I mean, he was not ashamed of that. Speaking of teams and Sam Burns, are you going to make the argument now for the Ryder Cup? Or are you going to wait a couple of weeks? I mean,
I'm going to keep waiting.
You sure? Because usually that's when you get in, right? Early, right before anyone else, you slide in and you're the first to get say this territory is mine.
I don't even think he's barely made any headway in the standings. I saw Max Homa who didn't have a good Sunday in Tampa. He didn't make up any ground. I mean, there's just so many top tier Americans. I would still much rather have a team that had Scottie Scheffler, considering his body of work, over Sam Burns and his one win right now in Tampa.
You clearly are not a fan of Sam. So we're going to move on now because I do want to get into these invitations.
I just said he's the eighth best under 25. That's strong company.
This is out of character for you.
This is historic. This is an unprecedented level of depth and greatness in this particular category. That's why I kind of just threw it out there and was just spitballing. And then when I actually sat down and came up with the names, I said, my God, has there ever been so many great players at such a young age? And you can talk about where that come from, the international game, the college golf system, the Corn Ferry Tour, getting these guys prepared. I mean, it is really, really deep and really strong.
Oh, and you're right. I think you touched on the one. They're just better prepared. When they get to the PGA Tour now, they are not wide-eyed. Like it used to be back not that long ago. I would say 10 years ago when the player showed up on the PGA Tour fresh out of college, there was going to be a learning curve. You were going to have to figure out where to stay. You were going to have to learn the golf courses. You're going to have to figure out how to pay your caddy and find someone that you clicked with. All of these things, like those things are now not even on the radar. It seems like all of these young players show up tour ready. Flipping it forward, I do want to talk about Phil because this fascinates me. He said last week, he told ESPN that he's going to try to qualify for the U.S. Open. He'll be at the Columbus Qualifier, which will be a must-see event. However, if he does not do that, he's not sure if he would take a special invitation to the U.S. Open. Two things on this one. One, if you're the USGA, do you even offer him one now? And two, is he bluffing?
Well, it's hard to say if he's bluffing because he was in the exact same situation last year with the U.S. Open returning to Wingfoot, where, of course, he suffered one of the most crushing losses of his career in 2006 and said that he didn't want an exemption into the U.S. Open. He wanted to earn it his own way. Well, because of the pandemic, USGA changed some of the qualifying rules, and Phil, through his world ranking, which has since then plummeted, he got in and played predictably terrible at the U.S. Open and missed yet another cut. So I don't know if he's bluffing because we didn't get into that situation last year to find out. I'm curious, why would he even decline one rather than just pride saying I don't want a freebie, I don't want a handout? What's behind this?
I don't want to misspeak and I don't want to overstate this, but I do know a couple people in that camp around Phil to the point that when I brought this up recently to someone who knows I kind of rolled my eyes, thinking, of course he would take the invitation. He wants to play it. It's the last thing that's missing from the resume. How in the world would he not do that? And this person guaranteed me, no, he would not. Because there is a distrust, there's a distaste, there's a dislike between Phil Mickelson and that organization. Now, it's not reciprocal. I'm sure to the USGA, this is just how we do business. But when it comes to Phil and the USGA, you can just trace that history. Go back to Shinnecock. He didn't do that because he had a lapse in judgment. He did that because he wanted to make a very, very public point when he stopped his ball from moving on the green. And he's done this before throughout the course of his career. I think in this particular case, he is very, very serious. Now, whether if he goes through with it, I'm curious, because that is, he's at the age now where you're not going to get too many cracks at this. And even though it would be the longest of long shots for him going to Torrey Pines, it is Torrey Pines. It is essentially the course he grew up on, or at least in the city he grew up in. So I am a little bit surprised, but no, I think there is a legitimate dislike, and he is at this point going to stick to his guns.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not getting too emotionally invested in this storyline. You call it the longest of long shots. It's borderline impossible. This is a player who hasn't finished inside the top 25 at the US Open.
I wrote him off at Pebble Beach. I can't write him off again. I've already done it once. I can't do it again. I once you write a guy off once, that's it. You're done.
He hasn't finished inside the top 25 at the U.S. Open since 2013, when he blew his shot at Marion, which was his last great chance to win the U.S. Open. And Torrey Pines, it may have been the golf course that he grew up on. There's certainly going to be a nostalgic element to this. He wants to play in front of however limited hometown fans that he does have before he makes the move to Jupiter. But he doesn't particularly like Torrey Pines either. I mean, ever since the redo, he has not played that golf course particularly well. I don't think he has a top 10 finish there in the past decade. And so I think there's a lot going on here. I certainly think there's, to your point, and I don't think it's unfair at all, that there's certainly a dislike, a distrust, a frosty relationship between Phil and the USGA. I think that's probably a very valid point. I think it's also, he doesn't particularly care for Torrey Pines as a golf course. And I'm not sure he even thinks deep down that he has a chance to win this golf tournament. You know, if Phil was 61st in the world and he just missed out on qualifying via the world ranking, and he didn't want to kind of go through the crapshoot that is 36 hole sectional qualifying, if he had a legitimate chance to win this golf tournament and he was playing well, then I think he would accept it, because, hey, this is a great shot for me to get into the tournament, a golf course I know well, and I can potentially steal this one. I don't think that's the case at all. I think Phil knows he has no chance. The USGA matter certainly doesn't help. The golf course, despite kind of having that nostalgic element, I don't think it's enough to carry over. It wouldn't surprise me at all if we don't see Phil there for Father's Day weekend when he's going to turn, 52 years old?
Yes, correct. And very frosty. That's the way I would put it. Now, the other side of this coin is someone who did get an invitation and accepted it, Ricky Fowler, into the PGA Championship. And I believe, if I just looked that up correctly, he has dropped to 116th in the world. Yes. And we could see even now the argument whether if PGA of America should have, if he deserved it, everything that goes into that. This kind of dovetails off of what we talked about last week about the Player Impact Program. About this is sort of a direct result of that. Is he getting this invitation because he's done anything competitively to deserve it? No, absolutely not. All you have to do is look at his record. It doesn't take, it's a very, very simple Google search. He has done nothing in the last, let's call it 12 months, to deserve this. This is all about getting eyeballs. So in that context, tournaments give sponsor exemptions all the time to players who don't necessarily probably deserve it, but tournament directors feel like they move the needle. In this particular case, tournament directors at the PGA of America, they feel like he moves the needle. I don't have a problem with it.
I don't have a problem with it either. And I don't think it's a crazy stretch. I mean, I know Ricky has really struggled in 2021 as he's working through these swing changes with Coach John Tillery. But I mean, he was 53rd in the world at the end of 2020. And so let's just say the pandemic doesn't happen and he's able to kind of play his way out of this rut. You know, if the tour isn't shut down for 3.5 months, you're looking at a whole different scenario. And maybe he would have been inside the top 100 in the world ranking, and then he would have gotten into the PGA Championship by virtue of his spot in the 2018 U.S. Ryder Cup team, which is one of the qualifications. And so I think you can make the argument that way. And the fact of the matter is, look, I know he's not in the best of form right now, but he's still finished inside the top 20, I think, four times over the past calendar year. I mean, I like him getting a freebie more than some also ran who has absolutely zero shot to win the golf tournament. Like, would it be a total shock if Ricky was in contention at Kiowa?
Yeah, I would be shocked. Absolutely. Yeah. Shocked. No, it totally would be.
You would be shocked. You would be shocked.
I'd be shocked because he has done nothing. No. He has done nothing. I mean, for him to turn it around in 1 week on a very, very demanding golf course against arguably the best field in golf.
He just finished inside the top 20 in his last tournament at the Texas Open.
All right.
17th. On one of the most difficult golf courses on the regular PGA Tour Rota. So, like, it would not be a shocker.
Are you comparing TPC San Antonio to Kiowa?
It would not be a shocker to see him in contention. To win? Yeah. Because that's the strongest major championship field of the year. To win, yeah, it would be a shocker. To be in contention, to be inside the top 10, inside the top 20, which is basically all you want out of your sponsor exemption, no, I don't think that's totally unrealistic. And I like it more than some of these other guys that they could have given a free pass to, who basically just want to have a victory lap.
Again, I don't have a problem with it. I would be shocked. If you and I are sitting around Sunday morning trying to figure out how we're going to ride a Ricky Fowler gamer, then we can circle back around on this, but I'm going to be pretty sure.
That's a problem I would like to have.
No. That's one I'd like to have as well, but I just don't see that happening.
Rather than trying to track down and translate Japanese media members' insights over a Hideki route.
I miss Hideki already. I want him to come back. I want him to hold
the
press conference.
We're going to see him at the Nelson. He was just presented with an award from the Prime Minister of Japan. He has fulfilled his 14-day quarantine. Can you imagine that, Rex? Like, can you imagine that? So you just win the Masters. It is the highlight of your entire life. This is something you've worked for forever, and then you get stuck schlepping through the Atlanta airport. I think he connected through Detroit, and then
Delta.
Then he flies into Tokyo. He has to sit in his hotel room with no friends and family for 14 days. Two full weeks.
But you have the green jacket. I mean, if I'm going to get locked in a hotel room.
You can't do anything with it. You can't show it off.
You don't think he was wearing it
to dinner?
Oh, he was wearing it around that hotel room. He was shaking imaginary hands, taking imaginary pictures. Absolutely. I can see that happening. Sure.
It's just mind-boggling.
Yes.
Can you imagine that scenario? It's crazy.
No, it is a crazy scenario. And I do want to touch, both of us had eventful weeks. We'll get to mine soon. I don't want to give too much away here, but you are moving into a new house. And so we're going to miss the flower room. So whenever you're going to move, I feel like you have to do one more podcast from the flower room just so we could say goodbye properly.
I mean, the flower room will be moving. It won't be the exact same room, but I can assure you that some of the floral prints, some of the Lily Pulitzer furniture will be coming with us. So though the flower room will be changed, I prefer to think of it as flower room 2.0, and it'd actually be more fitting. We're moving up to Ponte Vedra Beach. My wife just got a new job in Jacksonville, so now I can retire early. She's going to be. So we're going to be up in Ponte Vedra Beach. We're going to be 15 minutes from the beach. Like that vibe would actually work, as opposed to being in landlocked Orlando, you know, a house that we're 45 minutes from the beach. It's 95 degrees here today, oppressively humid. It's just, I just don't like the vibe of that room in this house. And so
I don't like the internet
connection.
I don't like the Wi-Fi connection. Let's just hope the Wi-Fi connection in the new flower room is a little bit better, just so when we circle back.
Come on, fiber optic. Come on through in Ponte Vedra Beach.
Now, I love the way you point out how close you are to the beach, and you never mentioned that you're even closer to the PGA Tour headquarters.
I mean, I'm not going to be having lunch there.
You don't know that. Sure, you can pop in.
I have plenty of friends who work for the PGA Tour.
You do.
I look forward to seeing their new headquarters. Hello, Tito. But no, it's gonna be a good move for us. The podcasts these next couple of weeks could certainly be interesting because I'll be certainly torn in a couple of different directions. I think I feel like we're glossing over the fact of your week, because although I'm going to be moving, you had a fortnight in San Diego. Are you still in San Diego, or is that just a little California dreaming for 3 or 4 days?
No, I was there 48 hours, man. Fortnight, absolutely not. I was there 48 hours. I flew from New Orleans.
You spent $1,500 of our precious company's budget for 48 hours?
I don't know how you saw that's what it cost. That might have been how much it cost. I didn't even look, if I'm being quite honest. I don't. You know more about it than I do, apparently. But I flew from New Orleans after covering the Zurich Classic to San Francisco. I made it to my tee time at the Olympic Club for U.S. Women's Open Media Day late, so I only got 12 holes in there. But I did get a burger 12 dog. Holes.
That's probably something what the USGA wants. Play quicker.
It was good.
Hybrid, it's a new hybrid model.
And I did get the burger dog, which is as good as advertised. Oh, it was delicious. It was divine. And I said last week in the podcast that I wasn't necessarily looking forward to the second round, which was San Diego. Yes. I'm sorry, it was Torrey Pines.
Torrey Pines.
So Monday night I flew down to San Diego, and then we played Tuesday morning, and
how did you play at Olympic?
12 holes. It was a long walk. We walked, again, I was fresh off a very, very long flight after a very, very long week in New Orleans. So it was difficult. It was not as enjoyable as I thought it was.
How many pars in 12 holes?
I think I made like one, maybe. It was hard. I drove the ball great. I had 150 yards into every hole, and between the wind and the uphill, I was told that, yeah, it's 190 effectively. So I had a lot of 190 approach shots.
You drove the ball great?
Yeah, really good. Excellent. Wow. Which leads to the next conversation, which is about U.S. Open Media Day. And I do, you know, I did take the time to talk to officials and get an idea of what they're thinking for the actual tournament course for the U.S. Open, if you have any interest in that. However, the round itself was even better, because I got to play with Mike Wan, who's the LPGA commissioner and will become the chief executive of the USGA after the US Open and Mike Davis retires. And I didn't know him, so it was a great opportunity to get to know him. And I will say this, and obviously that was 5 hours of very well spent time for me, and I don't want to give away any confidences, but I get the feeling that that organization is going to change dramatically under his watch.
Mike Wan is absolutely an electric personality. His enthusiasm for life, his job, the game of golf is absolutely infectious. I'm insanely jealous that you were able to spend 5 hours with him. What did he make of your hacking golf game, and what kind of player was he?
No, he was kind. I apologize in advance, and he apologized a little bit as well. And it turns out that he lives very, very close to where I live in Orlando, which was surprising. I did not know he lived in the Lake Mary neighborhood, and we kind of run in the same circles. Our kids kind of run in the same circles, which was sort of weird. But
you and Mike Wan run in the same circles.
Well, yeah, as far as, you know, places we go to dinner and stuff like that. Clearly, he has a better Rolodex than I do, and you know, his corporate card is very, very.
He's not worried about that $1,500 flight.
No, apparently either am I, because I had no idea that's how much it costs. But I'll say this, and this is why I wanted just to point out that the organization is I'm not going to say change, but it certainly will be altered in some way. That when I was asking Mike about how's the search going for a new LPGA commissioner, he was kind of talking me through who he thought it might be and why. And I said, what's the most important thing of being a commissioner of a sports league, of the LPGA, or whatever the case may be? And he thought about it for a minute, and he goes, look, you have to be able to sell. Like, I have to be able to make a phone call to a corporate sponsor and figure out how to close the deal. I mean, you're a salesman, pretty much. And you're trying to sell a product that obviously he believes in, that he's very passionate about. But the second thing, and he said, this is the most important, he goes, you have to have humility. He goes, because you have to stand on a range and take all of the bad thoughts that a player has about what is going right and wrong with the tour. And you have to be willing to stand in the corporate office and take all of the bad shots that you're going to get from an executive. And this just keeps going down the line. And he goes, you have to realize that, look, I'm the one that's going to take these arrows. Like, this is part of the job, and you just have to live with it. And I thought that was fascinating to me.
Who did he think would be in line for the commissionership?
Didn't actually say. I didn't even know. We didn't talk specifics, honestly, and I wouldn't give away anything they told me in secret. But I was surprised to read stories today, and this isn't from him, that Susie Whaley from the PGA of America did put her name in the ring and then withdrew it. So I was a little curious about that. I don't know enough about the LPGA to understand why, but I did find that curious.
How did Torrey Pines play? A month and a half out from when they're going to be hosting the World's Best.
It was much more enjoyable. When I'd played the South course before, I think I said it on the podcast last week that I was looking forward to the Olympic Club walking in South course
and to walking off the fourth hole and potentially going to play in the North.
No, I was just going to walk in the ocean was kind of the deal. I'm just going to let myself fall down the cliff to Black's Beach and walk in the ocean.
Yeah, you're going to go hang gliding.
Mike Wan wanted, we talked about it all day long. He wants to go hang gliding. So that gives you an idea.
What a menace.
The rough wasn't up. So it wasn't US Open rough and the greens were very, very firm. I love the way the golf course played though. I mean, certainly you look at some of the holes and you know where the demanding holes are and where the holes where you can score a little bit. But even for us, for me, the hack in the group, pars and even a birdie on the par 5 14th, which I was very proud of.
Oh my, that's a good birdie. I believe that's the hole that kind of triggered Tiger's comeback on Saturday of the 08 US Open, if I'm correct. I believe he holed out for eagle from over the back. Is that right?
That's correct.
Chipping from short. I think he holed
it. Chipped in from right of the green. It was kind of right and over a bunker. You know, it was one of those magical Tiger shots. And it was a total stunt. And you know, I don't do this stuff, but they recreated Tiger's putt on the 72nd hole of the 2000.
I saw the video.
Yes, yes. And then we were told, now just to be clear about this, we were told to, you know, to have a reaction, either one way or the other. If you make the putt, you miss the putt, have a reaction, because they were filming everyone. And if you watch, Mike went before me, and so I got a good read, and he's a good caddy. And so that was a one shot, one take deal. I made the putt. I don't know what the big deal is. A little right to left, just get it moving down the hill. Like, come on, we're really going to keep celebrating this thing? Like, all right, he made a putt. But I was very impressed with my celebration, if I have to say so. And I didn't notice it.
It was awesome. It was spot on. And so was Juan's. It was perfect.
He's in the background. I didn't even realize that of the video. He's celebrating more than I was.
So it's so good. You guys got to, I think you retweeted it. You guys got to find that on Twitter. And speaking of which, Rex, there was a bit of a kerfuffle on social media. And you would have some keen insight in this since you actually attended the event. But as usual, there's a war raging between old media and new media. And there was a particular golf blogger who pointed out the surplus of social media influencers who descended upon Torrey Pines for no sole purpose other than apparently posting their musings on social media, while, you know, dogged reporters like yourself were talking to John Bodenhammer and chatting up Mike Wan and trying to do your job professionally and gather some insights leading into the US Open. What was the vibe there? Did you see more influencers than usual? I know you are an influencer, yourself, but did you see anything amiss?
I love the way you pose this, old media versus new media, because I'm squarely in old media, so I don't know.
Oh, ancient.
Where you think I'm?
Dinosaur.
Yes, ancient media. Yes, dead media is where I'm at. I did, and what was interesting is they were in San Francisco. A lot of the social media influencers were in San Francisco for the Women's Open Media Day, and we were kind of all on the same flight from there down to San Diego on Monday night, and I was taken by how many there were. Like I was really surprised. I don't know many of these people. I kind of just know them by reputation and the work they do. And I would counter by saying that no, there weren't a lot of traditional print journalists there. I think it was myself and maybe a handful others, but you and I can attest that there aren't a lot of us ink stained
anyway,
wretches
yes.
around anyway, let alone ones that are going to make a trip across the country to play in a US Open Media Day. So I didn't find it odd. And I didn't find it odd that, no, I wouldn't have expected the social influencers to be standing there next to myself and Ron Green Jr. as we interviewed John Bodenhammer about what to expect in June, because that's not their thing, right? I mean, I would argue that they're there to be more social media savvy than I was, and I'm sure they were.
Just to put a fine point, did it bother you at all that there were so many social media influencers there? Can you just put this on the record once and for all?
No. No, I mean, why? What? Again, this goes back to what I just said about the PGA of America and the Ricky Fowler invitation. Look, it's you run a tournament. It's your job to try to publicize and get people interested in that tournament in any way you can. And apparently the folks at the USGA feel like that that's the way to do it. I wasn't surprised by it, nor was I taken by the idea that there was too many of them. I don't know what that number would represent to be a proper number of social media influencers, but no, I didn't.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I am not bothered by this at all. There is room at the table for all of us. Traditional journalists, social media influencers, the folks like Fried Egg and No Laying Up and Barstool, like they all are in their own lane and it's great. And if it can help promote coverage of the tournament or lead, you know, the road all the way back to reading us on golfchannel.com or seeing us on live from or wherever else we're going to appear, I think that's a good thing. All of this is a good thing. It bothers me when I see these types of critiques. There's no need, Rex, for an old media versus new media war. And that's probably because I'm rapidly approaching middle-aged golf media.
I would go further. I will say the Barstool guys, they had, by my count, they had six folks there. And I can't say I was bothered by it. I was impressed by it. Like, if you've got a staff and you can send six people to a media day, man, you got yourself a staff. Like, I don't work for that staff.
Like, Barstool's not for everybody. We don't need to get into their history and reputation. All of my experiences personally with Riggs and the gang have been really good. They've been supportive of our work. And so there is room at the table for all of us. You're not going to like all of them. You're not going to appreciate what they do, but I like anybody who puts in the work and wants to grow coverage of the game. I think just there's nothing wrong with it.
All right, we're going to get out of here with, you did send me some pictures of you smoking some sort of meat. What was on the menu on Sunday?
So ironically enough, I was doing chicken wings last night when we got the call that we did get the house. I overcooked them slightly because I was distracted and forgot they were on it. That's why I didn't show you a finished product. But I did. I did do wings on the Gateway Drum, which I absolutely love. Just picked up a flat iron steak. We're gonna grill that off this week. Got some chicken thighs, boneless, skinless, of course, because that's the only way to do chicken thighs. And I got some salmon that I'm looking forward to smoking on a cedar plank. So it's gonna be a big week, Rex. I do have a NCAA selection show, the men's regionals on Wednesday. Other than that, I'm going headlong in the grill game this week.
And while we're at it, we could touch on this offline if that makes you more comfortable. But whatever you don't need of those seven or eight grills you've got laying around your backyard.
No, because there is a patio. The homeowner, they built this house in 2018. It's like they knew I was coming. They built this like outdoor courtyard, and they have, I guess you would call it like a gazebo type structure. It's like it was made to house my five grills. Like, it's exactly where it would go, and you could still have the covered lanai where you would have, you know, couches and TVs and that type of thing, and then I could still have a yard. It's like they knew I was coming, so I can put the Traeger over here, the Gateway Drum over here, the PK over here, the Big Green Ugly over here. I can do a little Smoky Joe over here. I can bring back the Weber Smoky Mountain if I want to get to that game. I mean, the possibilities are endless.
Endless. I know. Look at you. I can't be more happy for you, and I will miss the flower room. That'll do it for this edition of the Golf Central Podcast presented by Callaway Golf. Talk to you next week.